New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani has been bragging about how safe the city is now that he's in charge. And city police recently released data showing record low violent crime. At the same time, 6 people were stabbed in Penn Station this weekend, and urban disorder continues to be a potent political concern across the nation, even as overall violent crime is dropping. So what's really going on in New York and America's cities? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Matthew Welch, Nick Gillespie, and very special guest, the mastermind, the genius behind Reason's Morning Roundup newsletter, Liz Wolf. Welcome back to the podcast. Okay, we have 3 New Yorkers on this pod this week. And I just want to go around the panel and start by asking what your assessment is of the state of crime, disorder, just sort of the general feeling in New York City right now. Liz Wolf, let's start with you.
Well, our murder rate has gone down, which is pretty awesome. But then again, also, how could you want to kill people when you get to watch the Knicks like every night? Absolutely dominating. I will say that I, at least on my end, I do feel like this summer, and we typically see crime spikes in the summer months, has thus far been a little bit safer than other summers in recent memory. I'm not sure whether this is because Daniel Penny has started going to my church. So to some degree, I just have like vigilante justice guy around me whenever like my back is turned to the entrance these days. But yeah, I mean, I've noticed a little bit of a shift. I do also think that to some degree, this is because post-pandemic, the crime and disorder got so bad that at least my family individually started to just basically buy our way out of being in unsafe situations. So like we moved back to sort of a nicer area of Brooklyn, back from Rockaway in Queens. I tend to take more Ubers at night as opposed to taking the subway or the bus, in part because I want to avoid the crazies. I've been a little bit more choosy about which routes and which types of adventures I take my toddler on. To some degree, it's like because it got so bad for a bit there, we began to tailor our choices to, you know, really attempt to avoid some of the crazies. And I will say that like murder is one of the easiest crime categories to track. And we're very blessed that that has gone down in New York City, especially in the Bronx, which all of us are sort of insulated from the crime ups and downs in the Bronx. But that's historically where it's the worst. But there are a bunch of other areas that are really bad. A lot of quality of life issues, a lot of crazy public disorder on the subways. And, you know, subway system crime in particular has been a very hot button issue, I think, because people feel very vulnerable in that system. And it's also something that we New Yorkers are supposed to be able to routinely rely on. So I think it's a little bit of a sign of the times that things got so bad for a while that I started making choices that basically, you know, made living in New York more expensive for me, but allowed me to avoid this thing that was supposed to be accessible to all of us.
At least you have the option, the opportunity to make those choices. And I think if you look at a lot of policies, you know, even just around things like Uber that you see in cities happening right now, you look at what's going on in Seattle, where the rideshare union, you know, that runs the Uber drivers has made things so much more expensive. It's the most expensive city in the country right now to hail an Uber, right? In some cases, like you see liberal, you know, Democratic mayors who are pushing policies that make it harder for you to buy your way out. Matt Welch, how does your experience track? Is it like Liz Wolf's? Is that, I assume Daniel Penny is not going to your church?
Not that I'm aware of, but...
And Matt, you're one of the criminals, aren't you?
I think so, but I haven't showed up at crime statistics yet. I just think that 2020 is just the pig in the python of everything about American life and crime. Yep. Probably more than anything, it's kind of a mug's game to try to associate exact cause and effect for the crime rise after World War II, the crime drop beginning in the early 90s. But I think we can look at the COVID spike as saying whatever happened there was weird and big and bad, and we're kind of coming down from off of that almost everywhere. The places that have done it even more, I think, are the most interesting, like Baltimore has really like cut crime a lot, and I think that's through policing choices. I think in most places, it's probably just the same effect that's happened everywhere. In my personal life, the one thing that we notice is that, yeah, there's less neighborhood level disorder. The teens aren't running amok in my neighborhood as much
that's
as they
because
were.
Because you don't live in Washington, D.C., in Navy Yard near Robbie Suave.
I live in a place where the Italians keep it clean usually. But
so we've got Daniel Penny and the Italians, and that's who's enforcing order in New York.
I mean, that's kind of like if you want to look at it that way. But also there has been it's still much higher level of EDPs, emotionally disturbed persons that are visible on the streets, in the subway system in particular. your disturbance doesn't
it's
cause
first time
me
back a, in a while Come
a,
on.
A sense of threat. So we still have that. And I don't think that's showing no sign of going anywhere. And that's probably what happened at Penn Station. And it's certainly what's happening on the subways. And we've seen a lot more murders on the subways than there was almost none for about a decade up until the pandemic.
Yeah, the good news about that Penn Station stabbing, it's obviously bad news, but the good news is it does look like none of those people are going to end up dying. They're all going to survive. Nick, Matt mentioned Italians. I think that means you've got to go next here. What's your assessment of the state of New York?
Mamma mia. No, New York is, I think both what to build on what, both of my colleagues have said. One is people change their behavior in response to perceptions of crime. And realities of crime. And also the pandemic was a black swan event that really shook everything in a weird way. And we're settling back down to something approaching the pre-pandemic crime trends and things like that. Rape and felonious assault in New York are up over the past 2 years. Those are the outliers, according to the NYPD, whereas murders, robbery, burglary, grand larceny, and grand theft auto is down. So these are good things. Most of those are reflected broadly in national trends in big cities, not all big cities, but most of them. So we're seeing something come back. And I think, the one thing from a libertarian point of view that's worth talking about is this mitigates the idea that you need massive surveillance, everywhere all the time and, have the National Guard policing places and things like that. And it also shines a light on the absurdities of extreme kind of defund the police mentalities. I think, America is figuring out how to get back to something like a decades long decrease in crime, much of which may be outside of the ability of us to really understand all that well. A lot of it might just be demographic.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that we're settling back into a pre-pandemic normal, though. The criminologist, crime analyst Jeff Asher is already predicting that 2026 is going to have the lowest murder rate in the United States ever recorded. It's just objectively good news. But one thing you see, to go back to Matt's point, when you look at Asher's kind of annual chart of murders, Liz, is the thing that that Matt pointed out about COVID, about this giant spike, right? It's 2020 and 2021, this huge, huge increase in murders. And that was when the public health establishment was pretty united in saying, look, we've got to lock people down. You've got to stay home, right? We can't have kind of normal social activity. Does it seem like maybe there is, a lesson for public health about like doing stuff that doesn't cause people to do a bunch more murders?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think, the public health authorities are, to some degree, the root of so many of our problems nowadays. We can go all bowling alone if we really want to. I will note just before we move ahead, the one caveat to the rape statistic that Nick cited, which is totally correct, but is that I think the definition of rape in New York State basically changed. I believe it was last year, perhaps. And so to some degree, that's a little bit of like noise from a legal definition change that we should just note because reasons, we're the exact type of place to really kind of split hairs about that. And I think that's a good thing to do. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. The public health authorities are totally to blame here. But I will also note that like, to some degree, some of us wonder whether the sort of rise in emotionally disturbed persons being out in the public is sort of all within our heads, or maybe it's a factor of, because of the pandemic, depressed overall subway ridership for a while, the fact that you had not only these crazies circulating within the subway system and out on the streets, but also fewer normal people, fewer strap hangers commuting to work. That is definitely
right. So the people with problems then ended up representing a larger portion of the public population.
And to some degree, that's absolutely true. But I think one thing that's kind of interesting is that we're noticing, even as of 2025 and 2026 data, that, you know, we're seeing, for example, fewer robberies and more assaults. There's been Vital City does a lot of good data collection on this, basically reflecting, they put it as reflecting a broader societal shift in the nature of violence. They also go into some detail about who it is that's a violent crime offender within the subway system and how they have really distinct, you know, criminal profiles and patterns. Among individuals arrested for a violent subway crime in 2022 and 2023, 16.8% had a prior arrest for violent subway crime during the last 6 years. 70% had a prior arrest for violent crime anywhere in the city. And 25% of those people had an arrest for fare beating. So I think one thing that I would expect to see as we thankfully drive some of these crime rates down and people begin to feel a little bit safer, but as we have these high profile stabbings like what just happened in Penn, you know, I think that one thing that will come, you know, into the public square that we're going to have to debate and libertarians will have to decide how we feel about this is how much subway fare beating enforcement we want to do. I know this is, you know, something that Peter Moskos has a lot of opinions on Twitter. And this is something that various mayoral administrations in New York have prioritized or deprioritized. But I think it's going to be a question that libertarians have to ask themselves, which is like, well, how much do we care about enforcing the laws that are on the books? Including things that, you know, you could say they're victimless crimes. The actual turnstile jumping is not especially awful, but we see a huge correlation with those people also being the ones who statistically commit these crimes. And fundamentally, it's not really fair for them to be stealing from our city. That $2.90 that I pay really ought to be paid by every single other person as well. And if you're legitimately poor, our city already has systems set up to make it so that you can have reduced fare. So I would just expect this to become a little bit more of a salient political issue in the city over the next few years.
Nick, what do you think the policy lessons are for libertarians?
Well, I mean, I think along those lines, you know, one of the questions is to look at cities that enforce more public nuisance or public disorder laws and just see how that's working. Because I agree. I mean, it really bugs me when I see people beat fares and things like that, because the whole, you know, first off, the fare is subsidized. There are voluminous programs for people who can't afford subway token or, you know, subway rides to get them and things like that. And it's just, it's bad. It's micro looting, you know, you're doing it against the city instead of Whole Foods or something like that. And it doesn't mean that you should be busted, you know, and sent up to Sing Sing or something like that. But it is, you know, it's a question of like how much order, disorder do you tolerate? And I'm less clear on all of the correlations and things like that. But I would be very interested in looking at, you know, the ways in which different areas do this kind of stuff. You know, there are more unhoused homeless people in California than there are in Texas and Florida. Those are policy choices as much as lifestyle preferences, and it's worth working through all of that.
Matt, you edited the nation's premier libertarian journal for a lot of years, so you know that there's disagreement in libertarian world about all of this stuff. And I just kind of want to get your take on, you know, what Nick said, what Liz Wolf said about this kind of going after people who are low level offenders, because the argument isn't just, well, they're looting the city. It's that people who offend in a low level way are more likely to do something that's a bigger crime. That's, you know, they're just likely to be antisocial and to do stuff that you don't want them doing. And so that's why you have to have police going after them. And if you extrapolate that argument, a lot of people who sort of buy a strong version of it end up saying, well, that's why we have to go after guns and drugs as well.
Well, that happened here in New York pretty notoriously for a long time with stop and frisk. Yeah. A lot of people who, you know,
and
smoke
Reason
a lot
was
less
pretty
pot
broadly
than the other two people on
opposed to stop and frisk.
On kind of, I mean, listen, you
know, so individual was, liberty, so personal constitutional grounds, right?
Right. But just to be clear, so was George Kelling, who was the co-founder of Broken Windows Policing. And even
Bill Bratton, at some point said, like, we got the gains in the first, you know, 4 or 5 years. Yeah. I don't remember exactly what it was. And now we're just harassing poor people. We need to stop doing that. Look, I mean, obviously, Nick and Liz are narcs and duly noted. But also this is an easy...
I spend most of the week undercover at a local high school, man.
I would also... Narcs who will see at what age they stop letting their kids go underneath the turnstile. That'll be interesting to watch. But there are technological solutions to this. It's not actually hard to build a thing that you can't jump over. So I don't expect
maybe you're not so limber, Matt, but I feel pretty good. I will say, I feel like the thing that we're advocating for is stop and frisk and then stop, right? Like not stop and frisk that goes on interminably for many, many years, such that we're just, you know, throwing people in jail long after the main problem has been solved. Like we should be very picky with how we deploy state resources as well as how we deploy state power, right? And so to some degree, it's like, if we could just do an aggressive enforcement of, like, you know, making sure that fare evasion doesn't happen and just have some sort of very targeted campaign to minimize that. Okay, great. But then the state needs to figure out how to back the hell off to just solve the problem to the greatest degree possible. It doesn't even need to be 100% solved. I would take like 80%, you know? And to some degree, that's what Jessica Tisch has already done in, it's a different situation, but in the Bronx, basically they had a really, really targeted enforcement strategy where they split the North Bronx and the South Bronx and basically devoted way more police resources, way more foot patrols to basically say, hey, look, it's honestly not the bougie area of Brooklyn that Matt lives in that's the main thing that's contributing to our super high homicide rate in the city. It's the gangs in the South Bronx. And so Jessica Tisch, to her credit, decided to actually enforce in a very targeted way. And I think that they could do that when it comes to subway system crime as well.
If you have laws on the books, then you probably need to enforce them. The solution isn't don't enforce laws that are on the books. The solution is if they are bad laws, take them off the books, but leave the good ones on and actually enforce them. And this seems to, this is a problem, I think, for Democrats in cities all over the country, is their argument has been, it's not necessarily always today, but their argument has often been basically, we're just not going to enforce the laws on the books, but we're also not going to change the laws. That is not tenable. When we come back, we are going to talk about another American city where crime and disorder have been potent political issues, Los Angeles, and all of the various elections in California in just a moment. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme is Reason and Love. It explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, Alexis de Tocqueville. They'll be in small, dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't just sit through lectures. They're going to practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students will have other activities. They can explore Chicago's landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week. Scholarships are also available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. All right, so speaking of blue states and blue cities, California had some elections last week, and I want to know, did we learn anything at all? Like, who won them? What the vote counts were? Two races I want to talk about are the governor's race and the Los Angeles mayoral race. Liz, I want to start with you. In the LA mayor's race, which you wrote about in the Reason Roundup newsletter this morning, seems like Republican Spencer Pratt is the loser. We don't know the full results, but he is pretty clearly in third place after a big vote dump. What do you think here happened? I mean, it looked like maybe he was surging. He had all of these AI ads that cast him as a superhero. Did they just not work?
It's kind of funny to me that people pay so much attention to the really ludicrous, like Star Wars-y AI ads, as opposed to the ones where he actually had pretty good direct-to-camera monologues, where he, I think, very appropriately criticized how LA has been governed for a really long time. It's kind of funny what gets all the attention versus what doesn't. So, yeah, I mean, maybe the AI-generated ads really rubbed people the wrong way, but I think probably on a fundamental level, people don't feel comfortable voting for the scrappy outsider that doesn't really read as super liberal. They probably have a hard time, you know, pulling the lever for a reality TV star to some degree. In LA, I would imagine there's some amount of like, he has no experience. He hasn't really held down a real job. But I will say that just like from a libertarian perspective, the like core critiques that Spencer Pratt was able to lodge, I think were really reasonable. He, at one point in one of his videos, summarized Karen Bass's like taxpayer funded dental restoration for homeless meth addicts, and basically was like, when it's other people's money for other people's stuff, neither cost nor quality matters. I'm sorry, this is just Milton Friedman, right? Like, he doesn't actually say it as such, but like, this is something that we've heard before. If you watch Free to Choose or read any Milton Friedman, like, this is a very, very common thing that he talks about. Another one of the campaign ads had a great thing about how, here's the quote, here you are slapping your phone alarm at 5 a.m. every day, sitting in traffic, working long hours, paying your taxes. And if you crack a tooth or need some veneers after grinding down your teeth from stress every night, you're going to pay $10,000. But if you simply quit your job and do meth every day while defecating on the street, Karen will give you a new set of chompers for free. I really, really like this approach. He's basically saying, not only are we expected to subsidize, you know, people who aren't really contributing to society at all, we're also being expected to pay for things that are really pretty non-essential. And, you know, there's always this question of like, okay, well, are our current expenditures actually working? No, it's not like the problem of people being addicted to meth and living on the streets in LA is actually solved. The question is always, why can't we give them more money? Why can't we give them more money? I think it's, we're seeing kind of an interesting time in politics. We saw Mamdani's success, showing that basically credentials and experience really don't matter. You can kind of just be a Bowdoin educated Nepo baby. And just ride the sort of social media wave, have enough savvy marketing to sort of get to political success. We're also now seeing
the ads
Graham
were good.
Blattner.
He's quite charming on camera.
What's that?
The ads were good. He's quite charming on camera. And they, and I do, in fact, think that unlike Spencer Pratt, Mamdani's ad strategy was quite effective at getting at like letting people know who he was and at kind of charming people, because he is just quite charming on camera.
Well,
Matt, I actually just want to...
I would say that he deployed AI to basically be able to target communities in Queens and translate it into their own languages. So to some degree, you have these massive ethnic enclaves that Mamdani was just able to speak to, but then also took the time to actually speak to them. And I think that that's one of the things that really sets him apart. What were you going to say, Nick?
I think these two situations aren't all that easily comparable, partly because Mamdani was an elected official, however, you know, mailing it in, he was part of the system. He was also speaking to a city in which he is, you know, kind of representative. I mean, he's to the left of the typical New Yorker, but he's part of the supermajority. Spencer Pratt was running as, you know, the exact opposite of LA is one of the most liberal cities in the country, and he was running far to the right of that with zero experience, with a terrible reputation. I mean, the public character he had was awful. I think the thing about Spencer Pratt's run is not that he did not make it into the runoff, but rather how well he did. And when you think about people like Rick Caruso, the big Pacific Palisades financier and whatnot, who has also been a player, and people like Matt's old pal and paymaster Richard Reardon, who was actually mayor of Los Angeles for a good stretch of time, and he was a pretty good mayor as far as these things go. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot to think about there. I mean, Spencer Pratt, you know, what Spencer Pratt should do is light a fire under the four or five actual political Republicans who aren't mentally insane in California to say, like, if a guy like that can get this far on this little, imagine if you were a serious political candidate with political experience, with policy experience, what might you be able to do, not just in LA, but throughout California? And the answer seems to be it's
but he
not
wasn't
really
running
clear.
An especially Republican campaign, was he? Is that your read of it?
Yeah, Spencer Pratt was absolutely running against the liberal far left policies of everybody in LA, which is absolutely the case. Nobody in LA runs as a Republican. Nobody's like, I'm the third coming.
I mean, that's sort of what I was saying. I think he ran an anti-incumbent and anti-Karen Bass and anti current city governance campaign, but I don't know whether it really reads as especially Republican to basically say, hey, clean up the damn city and you guys really botched some major emergencies, you know?
It read Republican enough where that was the biggest reason that people rejected him. I mean, you would hear that first, you'd hear Trump second, and then you would hear, like, you know, he sells crystals and is a weirdo third.
People in LA love that, though.
Just not elected officials. We want a party hack. who has done nothing and except governed really, really badly. The big takeaway for me for all of this is not any new revelation. It's just something that we've seen repeatedly over the last years, is that voters in California and in Los Angeles are not concerned at all with punishing the people who have misgoverned them terribly. And you can just see this by the defensive hand-waving about just how long it's taken to measure this election. You know, like to count the actual votes. California has a miserably slow record. It's just the slowest in the country by far. It is not the only state that has mail-in ballots that are allowed, you know, a week after Election Day. Other states do that. That's not the smartest thing to do, but they still have the slowest count. They're not the only large state out there counting ballots. Nate Silver over at Silver Bulletin has it. He didn't write it, but someone else at his publication wrote a very good breakdown of all the ways that California is just terrible at counting votes. And when people point this out, they're like, oh, well, you're a conspiracy theorist. And you know what? We just really care about making each vote count. And so that's just the way it is.
You know, Matt, California is the second or first largest economy in the world. So how dare you ever criticize
the that kind of tolerance. I mean, it's a state that has $100 billion trained to nowhere, and no one has been dragged tarred and feathered through the city streets because of this. Javier Becerra is leading in the gubernatorial race. What has he done that's been good?
Did Javier Becerra strike you out in a Little League game?
First of all, nobody did.
1900s.
Nobody did. Eugene Levers did that one
time. You are not wrong to demonize him as the ultimate do-nothing waste product who somehow becomes emperor of Rome, but I'm just curious. Is there a personal connection?
Zero personal connection whatsoever, and my paymaster, Richard Reardon, paid me $1,500 total in his lifetime, although you
so
paid
the
for some
so you come cheap.
Okay, I'm super cheap. It is, you know, in a state where there's living memory where they're putting yellow tape around playgrounds months and months after Ron DeSantis had opened all the schools in Florida, while Dr. Death was in his stupid costume on beaches. There's nobody who's going to punish any politician like that. Becerra was in charge of HHS during Biden administration and was terrible. And he was a lockdown guy. And so like, okay, let's have him. There's just no sense at all that Karen Bass, nobody in California, they've spent tens of billions of dollars throwing money at the problem of what to do with water storage. Because we need to have water around if there's going to be a fire. Right. None of those things have been built. Not one. Not a single one. And all of the politicians that were involved in never making any of that happen are still in power. And we're still going to return Karen Bass to power. Or if not, let's just get someone who's more socialist. So this is an electorate that is getting what it wants, good and hard. And good luck.
The main thing that's really striking to me about the mayoral election in Los Angeles, and I think this is a comparison that's appropriate to make with the mayoral election in New York, is that the best the Democratic establishment could do in both cases was Karen Bass and Andrew Cuomo. And this just says something to me about, like, these are not insignificant cities. These are not insignificant budgets. You know, these are not people put in charge of just governing a few people. We're talking about millions and millions of Americans. And it is worrisome to me that this is the best the Democratic establishment can do. And I think it hints at a sort of complacency that's really taken hold.
Okay, let's move on very quickly and talk about Republicans, specifically one Republican, Donald Trump. Remember when he promised no new wars and no forever wars? Well, he then went on to start a new war in Iran, and now he says he didn't actually mean no new wars. This weekend, hostilities started between Iran and Israel again. They appear to have stopped this morning, and Trump gave an interview on NBC's Meet the Press, where he was asked about his campaign promise to not start any new wars. And here's what he said in response. First of all, I didn't guarantee no war. Why would I have built the strongest military in the world? I didn't guarantee no war. I thought he actually did, Nick. What are we supposed to do about this when a president, when somebody runs on, we're not gonna get any war into any new wars, and he starts new wars again? I mean, this goes back to at least George W. Bush.
Yeah, no, I suspect that you make sure that he doesn't get a third term in the White House.
Well,
and I suspect
that's my
that
job.
His party, and you know, to go back to California briefly, depending on how their redistricting plays out, it's going to be, you know, that Trump's Republican Party is going to suffer a major reversal in the House, possibly in the Senate, but almost certainly in the House, precisely because of stuff like this. it is, you know, it is one thing to, you know, kind of troll people and do various things that are kind of on the margins. But the Iran war was extremely unpopular. It remains extremely unpopular. And Trump was absolutely unambiguous in what he was going to do. And this is a bad policy that he is doubling and tripling down on. And that's not going to play well. So one of the things that we can do as good libertarians is rehearse the reasons why the Iran war was obviously a mistake, that it was obviously a war of choice. And what do we do next? And, you know, that begins and ends in many ways with making sure that Donald Trump and the Republican Party that still is up to him, you know, to the teeth. I mean, even somebody like Thomas Massie, who got kicked out of office by Donald Trump, voted with him 90% of the time. Yeah, that the people who do that and enable Trump need to take a hike.
Yeah, so it's obviously it's just an incredibly unpopular war. And one of the reasons why is the economy, right? It's just driving up prices. It's making energy much more expensive. Matt, what do you kind of make of
it's also because it was unnecessary, but I'm sorry to dilate on that. Yeah, yeah, it has bad effects, but you know, World War II was, you know, had a devastating effect on the domestic economy, but there was a rationale that was spelled out for it that made people actually, you know, volunteer for it and things like that. You know, this is part and parcel of terrible foreign policy that Trump, you know, semi-promised to be a reprieve from, which is that he was not going to do stupid things without explaining, you know, doing why he was doing this or that. And it's a total failure. So regardless of the economic privation, which isn't helping, this would be an unpopular war. And it should be, because it's not in America's best interest to be fighting this war this way right now.
I agree. It's totally pointless. But there are specific effects here that are happening. And those specific effects are hitting people in their pocketbooks every day. They can feel that they can see it when they put gas in their car, right? Gas is $4, $5, $6 in some parts of the country. And people know this. And they know that it is because of the war in Iran. They know that it's because of tariffs. They know that it is because of Trump's policies. And these are all unilateral policies. Trump can't even say, well, you know, Congress did it, or there's some sort of independent agency, not that independent agencies actually meaningfully exist anymore. This is Trump's war. These are Trump's tariffs. This is Trump's economy, and he is to blame for this. But Matt, I did want to actually ask you just about the economic consequences here, because there was a jobs report last week, and actually it was pretty good. We added a bunch more jobs than we thought we were going to add, than economists expected. And also there were revisions backwards showing that the economy has been adding jobs at a faster clip than we thought all throughout this year. So what do you make of the economic toll here and how that is playing into the popularity of the war and the rest of it?
I mean, thank God the United States has emerged from COVID, arguably even the financial crisis, and certainly these problems of its own making better than most other comparable countries. It's just sort of the engine of the United States economy is spectacular. And so as bad as the federal government in particular has been at 1,000 different policies, and as bad as Trump has been, as you rightly point out, on stuff that he absolutely had a big button that he could push, and he pushed it, pushed the tariff button, pushed the war button. Here we go. As bad as all that is, we're still resilient enough so far to overcome it. And great and hooray for us. But everybody feels it, you know. I mean, I am price unconscious and I feel it. So imagine someone who actually pays attention to this stuff. It's crazy. And of course, it has effects. Problem for Trump is that in the Meet the Press interview, he was asked about when are prices going to go down? It's like, oh, well, you know, we think it's going to happen once we get a deal, and the deal is going to come soon. We've been hearing about how soon the deal has been coming in like every 6 days from Barak Ravid since March, I think it was. And the fundamentals are the same as they were in March, which is that the Iranians know that Trump doesn't have time on his side, and they do. So he's screwed. Like, his negotiating position gets worse. And right now they're taking the fight to Israel, trying to divide a wedge between Trump and Netanyahu, and knowing that American public opinion is souring on Israel to a degree that's very alarming for Israelis and for a portion of Americans as well. So his negotiating position just gets worse by the day as the economy continues to drag on. And I don't see any real positive end game here. It's going to be some kind of retreat that is masked with a lot of tough sounding talk, but we'll be, I think, in a much worse position than we were, 12 months ago.
Liz, just very quickly, is Trump's economy here and the way that his policies are driving up prices, through, like I said, through tariffs, through the war in Iran, and then also through some of the labor shortages that we've seen just because of his immigration regime. Is that the flip side to what we were talking about earlier with Democratic mayors of big blue cities who are pursuing policies that are driving prices up, and people hate it. People hate it, but they keep voting for them. And this keeps happening in both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, is you vote for people, and what people say is, oh, we don't like the economy because prices are too high. And then they get a politician who does stuff that makes prices higher.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time, Reason has very much sort of taken the line, all of us sort of in conjunction with each other, that like the future will be good. The future will be better than the past. And I think in many ways that's true. But the thing that I didn't totally foresee is that the future will be much more expensive than the past in a lot of meaningful ways. And it's interesting because at the same time, like we see, the price of a lot of technologies, the price of a lot of consumer goods really driven down. And yet at the same time, it's interesting because it's like the actual, people are rightfully sensitive to cost of living issues. And we see that, in big cities being raised by Democratic governance. And then we also see that, being raised by President Trump, by being raised by his decision to place tariffs on things, by the degree to which shipping corridors are really affected by what's going on in Iran, as well as like the price of oil and gas. So that's definitely an issue. The other thing that I would just consider is I'm curious about what emerges from this. I'm curious about whether the Trump and Bibi relationship is sort of irrevocably damaged as a result of this. It seems like tensions have been really absolutely wild. Today, with them exchanging very tense words, I believe early this morning and late last night, as well as a week ago, when Trump said, and I quote, to Netanyahu, "You're fucking crazy. You'd be in prison if it weren't for me. I'm saving your ass. Mm. Everybody hates you now. Everybody hates Israel because of this." Like, these are aggressive things to say to a fellow world leader. And I am curious to see what happens with that Trump-Netanyahu relationship. But the other thing that I'm really curious about is it seems like Israel is getting more and more aggressive with going after specific parts of Iran's nuclear arsenal and enriched uranium. And I'm curious to see whether that actually makes a dent. When the U.S. did that back many months ago, it didn't really. And so I'm curious about basically how this all ends, but that specific component, because that could render it so that the U.S. doesn't need to focus so much on the nuclear program component of that ceasefire deal with Iran, if Israel is sort of able to get there first.
Yeah, even if the United States ends its direct participation, this war looks like it could continue at a low level for quite a while. All right, we're going to come back right after this with a listener question about the future, artificial intelligence. And then we're going to talk about Bernie Sanders wanting to socialize AI, or maybe stop it. He's not sure which, right after this. Where will you be this July? If you believe in freedom, if you believe in thinking for yourself and you want to meet other people who feel the same way, there is only one place to be, and that's Freedom Fest. It's the world's fair of liberty, and it is in Las Vegas, July 8th through July 11th this year, this summer. Join thousands of liberty-minded Americans for four unforgettable days of ideas, debate, and celebration. This is not just an event, it is a movement. Go to freedomfest.com right now and use code REASON100 to save $100. That's freedomfest.com and code REASON100. Freedom, ideas, and action. Join the movement at Freedom Fest this year. All right, it's time again to answer a listener question. A reminder, we love to answer your questions. Please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. This week's listener question comes from Joe in Buffalo, who writes, "Hello, all. I've always been in the technology is good camp." That's a good camp to be in. "And I generally feel that that point is inarguable. However, listening to AI advocates, I am very concerned. With over 80 million surveillance cameras in the United States and both parties advocating for a muscular federal government, what is the likelihood we keep our freedoms? I realize an AI future is inevitable, make me feel better about it. Nick, you talked about how part of the sort of lesson of the crime drop is that we don't need all this surveillance, that like we can survive without it. Make Joe feel better about our AI future in which artificial intelligence and pervasive cameras intersect with each other.
Well, I'm thinking his name and location reminds me of an old guy I knew, Southside Joe from Buffalo. And there was no helping him. So if it's that guy, forget it. But for the rest of us, this is a dance that happens with every new technology. Oftentimes, new technologies are sold to the government as great surveillance technologies, great warfare technologies, and things like that. And it always works ultimately against the government. The moment I had for that, I was working in Manhattan, and this would have been in like 86 or 87, and the place I was working had a subscription to the Wall Street Journal, and they ran a piece about how North Korea had bought a ton of cameras and microphones to put into public areas in order to better surveil, you know, the people there in the Hermit Kingdom, the most surveilled place on Earth already. And the Wall Street Journal was reporting within hours, all of the equipment had gone missing and had been repurposed into receivers by people. And that happens all the time. And it doesn't mean you should just like willingly go along with whatever our AI overlords want, all of that kind of stuff. It means we should always put as many legal guardrails on everything as possible without killing industries or choking off private uses of things. But relax, Joe from Buffalo, because this happens all of the time. And even, you know, Orwell has the paradigmatic tell screen, which is always on, which you cannot turn the volume down to zero. So it's always humming in the background, forcing people to watch. And actually, it's a surveillance tool. You know, even in that kind of scenario, inevitably, the technology ends up flipping and increasing what people call surveillance, or kind of, you know, capture from below rather than, you know, people looking at you from above.
Matt, you're our technology correspondent. I'm curious just sort of what you think about this generally, but also more specifically, I want to ask you about someone you interviewed on another podcast recently, Matt Iglesias, who commented on a piece that Reason had published that was sort of skeptical about putting a bunch of surveillance cameras and technology on school buses. And it's sort of like the Reason piece made the argument, you know, that we often make, which is, look, the state is just sort of setting this up to surveil everyone everywhere and turn, you know, the world into a panopticon. And Iglesias was like, well, look, this seems like this is a good way to protect kids and like actually catch criminals. And so tie this back into our kind of crime discussion from earlier in the show. How do you feel about this? I mean, how do you feel sort of about all this surveillance technology generally?
Well, I mean, first of all, the important thing is to, when I was calling Nick and Liz narcs previously, I was mostly teasing my beloved work colleagues. When I call Matthew Iglesias a narc, I mean it with the entirety of my soul and my spine. He's someone who is bragged about like reporting cars that have their license plates obscured in DC because he wants to stop that type of behavior in order to make sure that they're, you know, surveilled by speed cameras.
Okay, so let me just push back. Like, it's not that necessarily that I agree with this, but the argument in favor of that is that's basically like enforcing fare jumping, that it is illegal to have that stuff covered. And the reason that people do that is that they get away with crimes that way.
Yeah, I use the word narc advisedly. You could say I would like there to be a shield large enough on the turnstile that you can't jump over it. That's one thing. And saying I am going to take a picture of this car and I'm going to send it to the cops. Those are two different layers of things. One is a narc and one is advocating a public policy position.
What does that have to do with AI cameras or cameras on school?
Listen, I was asked to respond to Matthew Iglesias for reasons that will remain obscure, perhaps. But AI, you know, being married to someone who's a private investigator, I am more aware than person should be about how many cameras are on how many license plates and how much of those databases are available to all kinds of private investigators and governmental agencies. It's not good, Bob. And as is, like, you know, being in southern Manhattan, you are constantly surveilled more than anywhere outside of North Korea with all the various surveillance cameras because of terrorism concerns. I think they're all these things are absolutely valid concerns to have.
Yep.
And I am not your guy who's going to lessen your anxieties about AI. I would just say that a good rule of thumb when dealing with some kind of scary, you know, corporates and their techs and stuff is to ask yourself honestly, how is this affecting your life right now? Me, it's affecting my life because I have a 17-year-old and 11-year-old, and AI is kind of everywhere, and it's affecting how like college is sort of adjudicated and how much the kids are kind of relying on it. This is where I see it the most, besides just the obvious awful slop fed to us on social media sites.
Well, in that case, Liz Wolf, how is this affecting your life?
Well,
honestly,
the main problem is I don't really know what people mean specifically when they're talking about AI. It seems like this reader is concerned specifically with surveillance cameras. And you should probably read The Transparent Society by David Brin. Really excellent book. Nick alluded to some of
David
the concepts
so good.
In that book earlier. But no, I mean, AI has become a little bit of this like meaningless catch-all term, specifically like LLMs, I find to be extremely useful. They're really good at helping you get legal questions answered, medical questions answered, drafting really low stakes legal documents, getting more customized risk assessments and like, you know, literature reviews. Basically, like I've used them to like scrape medical journals and give me reviews of the literature to better inform my decision making surrounding health issues for myself and my kids, for summarizing papal encyclicals, which I know Nick Gillespie is doing a lot of in his free time. I think AI is also really...
I read them in the original Latin.
I also think that AI is really useful for like vibe coding. Basically, now everyone can become a coder, and actually gifted coders are made so much more efficient. The areas in which I'm like very worried are, I think that AI will probably become or has already become very useful in the realm of warfare and autonomous weaponry. And this presents real gains and real costs to how we conduct warfare, right? Precision means fewer civilian lives are going to be lost, but like maybe more ease of assassination. I think that's just going to transform the current way we do things. And I think to some degree it already has. I think on a way
lower LLM targeting, I mean, the AI targeting is appears to be, there's at least, I don't think this is pinned down and proven, but there's at least some reason to believe that one of the reasons why the United States struck that girl's school in Iran was because that was pulled from an AI target list.
Yeah.
And so there are going to be mistakes that humans might not have made.
We're going to, I mean, we're going to run into many more of those issues. I think of similar importance, AI will probably take over customer service and we'll all be totally screwed forevermore. But I think similarly, like, AI is going to be a pathetic, horrifying balm for loneliness. And that's the area, like, not to be so extremely sort of Jonathan Haidt-y, but that's sort of where my head's at right now. I think it's important to pay attention to the ways in which it might culturally end up being really bad. I am worried about people, you know, relying on the replica bots, girlfriend, person from the internet, as opposed to, in the words of Waylon Jennings, a firm feeling woman, you know, real life human interaction, real friendships, real romantic relationships. I just think these things really matter. And I'm worried about what the future looks like when people delude themselves into thinking they don't. But it's just kind of ridiculous when people talk about AI as either all good or all bad. I'm curious about what specific application you're talking about and for which person, what type of use. So I just think it's going to be more important now, I think, as these products compete against each other. And as we also see a little bit of this race to develop American AI versus some of these Chinese LLM models, and we see more international competition. I think it's worth asking deep questions of yourself of like, well, what is it that AI can help me do in my own life? And is that aligned with my actual values?
I think that's a good place to start.
So just to bring it back to Southside Joe real quick about AI and surveillance. One of the things, you know, technology independent of AI, but it'll be supercharged by that, has made surveillance cameras more ubiquitous, surveillance more ubiquitous and more searchable. If we go back just a couple of years when people started getting Ring door cameras, doorbells and related technology, where suddenly you could surveil your neighbors like hundreds of feet, sometimes hundreds of yards away, police immediately moved into that and basically said, okay, let's start sharing this data. And it gave police unfettered access to a lot of footage that ultimately we've been reeling back using legal guardrails. And I think for Joe in Buffalo and elsewhere, in this particular instance, that's the thing that Ron Bailey over the years has written a lot about this. It's that, you know, the technologies are going to come. And oftentimes, typically the ones that stick around are very useful. And then it becomes incumbent upon politics and policy to rein in the government excesses of this. There are some benefits to that, but also, you know, things that we really need to deal with. So that's, you know, part of the way that process by which a technology, which seems to be only good for people in power to enforce power, it becomes something else.
Well, let's talk about the policy and the governance around this, because there are just a slew of AI proposals coming out of Democrats in particular, but also the Trump White House. And then I think most prominently is Bernie Sanders, who wants to nationalize, in some sense, the whole artificial intelligence industry. Last week, he announced that he would be putting forth legislation to create what he calls an American AI sovereign wealth fund that, in his description, would give the public a direct ownership stake in the largest AI companies in America. Liz, what do you think of Bernie Sanders' proposal, given your sort of wariness of some parts of AI? And also, isn't that more or less what Venezuela did to its oil industry, or like what, you know, the Soviet Union did to large portions of its economy, but for AI?
Yeah, I honestly think over-reliance on technology in the cultural realm and Bernie Sanders are sort of like tied for my least favorite things ever. From that op-ed that you're thinking of in the New York Times that Bernie Sanders wrote, here's a very revealing quote. Since AI is built on the collective knowledge of humanity, the wealth it generates must benefit humanity. Not just Mr. Musk, Mr. Altman, Dario Amodi, and other moguls whose companies are positioned to dominate the industry. Not the venture capitalists, blah, 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 blah. I don't really know where he's getting that from. Built on the collective knowledge of humanity. Okay, sure. The wealth it generates must benefit humanity. It will. It is. Like, are you kidding me? It already is. There seems to be this sense of like, well, the government can seize it and then it will continue to function and the way that it has been and be able to be developed at the same rate, which is obviously not true. But as the government exercises some sort of stake in it, some sort of ownership of it, the company won't be warped at all. But also this idea that like the wealth it generates currently isn't benefiting humanity, it makes no sense to me. And I think it's very concerning the degree to which politicians, specifically of the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and now Zohran Mamdani variety, seem to believe that they're entitled to these glorious creations, where I think we honestly don't know where we're going to end up in terms of how much of a disruptor AI will be. The thing that I'm also worried about is so many of these politicians are going into these questions with very fully formed priors. And I'm concerned about what happens when there is any form of mass job displacement and thinking about how politicians, I think, will be able to much more cleanly try to pick up the pieces left in AI's wake in that realm. I'm really, really worried about what sort of UBI things might be proposed to try to mitigate some of those effects.
Yeah, Matt, what do you think about this sort of concern about AI is going to take everybody's jobs? This is something that has been pushed at least by some of the leaders of the AI companies. And you have Bernie Sanders kind of jumping on board saying, well, if that's true, then what we need to do is essentially nationalize these companies. We're going to do a one-time 50% tax on the stock of the big AI companies. That's the main mechanism that he proposes in that piece about the sovereign wealth fund. We're going to take their money. We're going to then own it. And then the federal government would have the power through its voting shares and an equal representation on each company's board to block decisions that hurt our citizens and push for policies that help them. Like what he's basically saying is we want the federal government to run AI. Is that going to work out?
It's not going to work out. And yet it is not the most troubling of the proposals along these lines that I've heard over the last 3 days, because the president of the United States, who is someone who, unlike any Democrat in my lifetime, I believe, has actually forced government stakes into private companies, more than a dozen last time I looked, he suggested that it would be a beautiful thing a couple of days ago. Beautiful thing. If the U.S. The government took ownership stakes in AI companies, and he wants to have a meeting as soon as this week with various AI people, and of course Sam Bankman, whatever the hell his name is, Sam Altman. Like, those angels have a really crappy reliever.
Sam Altman Burger, yeah,
whatever. They all are terrible. Had suggested it to Trump in the White House. Thanks, dude. I worry about that because it's more likely to happen, because we know that Republicans won't do a damn thing about it. Unlike Bernie's 50%, that's going to seem a little aggressive, even to the idiotic Ro Khannas of the world and everybody else who thinks that you can, you know, wave a magic government wand and do whatever the hell you want with private industry. 50% is kind of a lot, but Trump can just do it. If you're famous enough, you could just do it. I'm afraid it'll happen. And it's a bad thing, because government, when you own even a small piece of a private company, then you're making that private company concerned with what the government thinks, instead of concerned with what their shareholders and customers think. So they're going to be a worse company for it. And then also a government that asserts the right that it can do this to any private entity that it wants to is a government that has way, way too much power. And there is no natural limit on that type of activity. It's bad. It's communist. So we shouldn't do communism in America. That's my radical
The epithet
take.
You just right. invented, like Pliny the Elder, I think Ro Khanna the Idiot is pretty beautiful. And that's how our style guys refer to him going forward.
Matt, I'm disappointed that you weren't able to work Graham Plattner into that. Do you want to give us
Nick,
a subordinate clause with Graham Plattner?
All right.
Something about AI tattoo removal.
All right.
It's a bad idea.
We've got to move on because some people have to go. So we're going to move on to our cultural recommendations, what we've been watching, reading, otherwise consuming in the cultural arena this week. Liz Wolf, let's start with you.
I have been consuming Mean Streets, the Martin Scorsese movie from 1973.
Holy shit, that is a great movie.
Featuring Harvey Keitel and Robert De Niro as Charlie and Johnny Boy. Mm-hmm. Charlie's basically, this all takes place in Nolita, the neighborhood where I go to church, where Nick used to live, I believe. And it takes place in the 70s. Basically, Charlie, the main character, Harvey Keitel, is, you know, deeply, profoundly torn between his like Catholic guilt and his mafia work. It features my church rather prominently. And it's really interesting because, you know, I think you can look at it from a perspective of just being interested in sort of the vibey crime aesthetic of it. Or you could be really interested in the music, which is absolutely extraordinary. We have the Ronettes, we have the Rolling Stones, we have the Shirelles. Like, it's just absolutely perfect. And I think an earlier use of like deploying popular music so beautifully to create this really vibey setting kind of reminds me of Goodfellas, but of course it predates Goodfellas, which is really awesome. If you like Goodfellas, if you like After Hours, if you like Casino, I think you'll like Mean Streets. And it also, I would just add, has extremely quotable scenes, like the legendary bar fight where the dialogue that precedes it is entirely Robert De Niro basically asking, like, what's a mook? Like, he gets insulted. And then there's this whole long, drawn out, ridiculous conversation about, you know, what the insult actually means as they're sort of throwing fists. And it's just beautiful on every level.
Great movie, great depiction of 1970s New York. Matt?
I consumed this great magazine. It's called Reason. The latest issue of it one of my...
Matt, just if you didn't read anything last week, just say it. Okay?
No. I could have been talking about the Martin Short documentary, but instead I'm talking about this thing, which blew my mind.
But you called that an audible?
I did, yeah, because this was just terrific. It's my favorite issue of Reason in many years. It's fantastic. It's tied to the 250th anniversary, which has showed up occasionally in my cultural recommendations, so it kind of hits me in the sweet spot. But just terrific essay from Stephanie Slade about the founders and their conflicts between liberalism or synthesis between liberalism and their religiosity. Nick's wonderful interview with Neil Gorsuch about Declaration of Independence is in print form. I had to just say that to get him to stop sniping at me here. And the cover essay from Charles, the great Charles Mann, about the ways in which the pre-existing Native Americans had influenced and helped create the world that the patriots and the revolutionaries then themselves kind of inherited and used in their revolution. Just marvelous stuff, little like baseball card things of each, a bunch of the founders. There's a Peter Bagg cartoon, for crying out loud, about the degenerate Sam Adams. It's just really terrific. It's a page turner, and all shouts out really to the magazine designer, Joanne Andreessen. This is some of the best work that she's done, and she's already fantastic. So if you just consume Reason in digital media, I beseech you to get thee to a newsstand or just subscribe to the damn thing already and get it. It's just a great physical thing to put in your hands. Check it out.
That just reminds me that next week in Washington, D.C., we have a debate about who is the best founder. It's going to be a boozy debate hooked to the piece I wrote for the 250th anniversary issue about how all of our founders were kind of drunks. In any case, if you want to attend this debate, you can go to reason.com/events. That's reason.com/events. I watched a movie that is a little bit older that I'd never seen before, Persepolis, 2007 movie about a little girl growing up in Iran during the revolution and escaping briefly at some point to Austria and sort of having all of this sort of like living in this world that the Iranian Revolution created and wanting a particular kind of Western and even more specifically than that, American freedom. And what she was drawn to was American art, was American culture, was American music in particular. And it is just a profoundly beautiful and also quite sad story. Really well animated in a kind of unique animation style that is based on a graphic novel by Marjane Satrapi, who is also a co-director on this film. Very sadly, she passed away just a couple of days ago, so she is no longer with us. But this movie is Persepolis. If you haven't seen it, you should watch it. It will put everything that is happening in Iran in perspective. Nick, final recommendation from you.
No. Just to very quickly second your recommendation, Peter, the movie is great. The graphic novel is great. There's a great Reason piece from 2003 about that, the graphic novel and reading Lolita in Tehran. And what is horrifying to think about is these works were written or published, you know, 20 years ago or more, and they are still exactly relevant in the same ways. It's just, it's really terrifying. But Persepolis is a great book of kind of becoming who you are. Really wonderful. I will pivot from that to a very American text. Red Sheet is the latest novel from James Ellroy, who is, he calls himself the Tolstoy of the crime novel, but he is so much more than that. It's so much better than Tolstoy as a novelist, particularly of America, particularly of LA and the noir elements. This is from his write-up of the book, Red Sheet, the novel. Red Sheet is an anti-communist novel. It stands foursquare in the tainted tradition of Ayn Rand and Mickey Spillane. Ellroy, he's using the third person, is out to scramble your long-held perceptions and force you into a state of jumped-up disavowal. This is, you know, in the he's written, you know, a shelf full of books that kind of look at the way in which power, money, elites, celebrity all feed into a horrifying world without closure and without limits on the horrors that people do to each other. This is that where the main character, who's a recurring character, is based on a real life horrible human being who was one of the sources for L.A. Confidential, Ellroy's novel that was turned into the wonderful movie. It looks at how the ways in which communists in American society, particularly in Hollywood in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, used all sorts of violence to achieve their ends. And, you know, this is a nightmare book. And it's when I was reading it, I was like, this is as if Whitaker Chambers and Leslie Fiedler had raised Ellroy, who was orphaned in the 50s, in a Skinner box and reinforcing him with all of the horrors of what communists actually are like on a very picayune level. It is just a fantastic book, Red Sheet by James Ellroy. It is stylistically a masterwork, probably his best since American Tabloid, but also thematically. This is a book, if you care about how power operates and about how celebrity culture operates and about how public mythos that gets, you know, spread through movies and novels and TV and newspapers. Red Sheet is just the book that will make you both want to visit LA and never, ever want to visit it ever again.
All right. Well, the way we are going to operate here is we are going to close out this show. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to Liz Wolf for joining us. Special guest, thanks to Matt and Nick. As always, if you like what we do here, you can donate to us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. You can support the Reason Foundation, the Reason Roundtable podcast. The Reason Roundtable, meanwhile, will be back in your feeds next week. We will return.